Random House Audiobooks presents Dark Rivers of the Heart by Dean Koontz, read for you by Anthony Heald, with a special author interview.
Dark Rivers of the Heart. Part 1. On a Strange Sea. All of us are travelers lost, our tickets arranged at a cost unknown but beyond our means. This odd itinerary of scenes, enigmatic, strange, unreal, leaves us unsure how to feel. No post-mortem journey is rife with more mystery than life. The Book of Counted Sorrows. Tremulous skeins of destiny flutter so ethereally around me, but then I feel its embrace is that of steel. The Book of Counted Sorrows. Chapter 1. With a woman on his mind and a deep uneasiness in his heart, Spencer Grant drove through the glistening night, searching for the red door. The vigilant dog sat silently beside him. Rain ticked on the roof of the truck. Without thunder or lightning, without wind, the storm had come in from the Pacific at the end of a somber February twilight. More than a drizzle, but less than a downpour, it sluiced all the energy out of the city. Los Angeles and environs became a metropolis without sharp edges, urgency, or spirit. Buildings blurred into one another, traffic flowed sluggishly, and streets deliquesced into gray mists. In Santa Monica, with the beaches and the black ocean to his right, Spencer stopped at a traffic light. Rocky, a mixed breed not quite as large as a Labrador, studied the road ahead with interest. When they were in the truck, a Ford Explorer, Rocky sometimes peered out the side windows at the passing scene, though he was more interested in what lay before them. Even when he was riding in the cargo area behind the front seats, the mutt rarely glanced out the rear window. He was skittish about watching the scenery recede. Maybe the motion made him dizzy in a way that oncoming scenery did not. Or perhaps Rocky associated the dwindling highway behind them with the past. He had good reason not to dwell on the past. So did Spencer. Waiting for the traffic signal, he raised one hand to his face. He had a habit of meditatively stroking his scar when troubled, as another man might finger a strand of worry beads. The feel of it soothed him, perhaps because it was a reminder that he'd survived the worst terror he would ever know, that life could have no more surprises dark enough to destroy him. The scar defined Spencer. He was a damaged man. Pale, slightly glossy, extending from his right ear to his chin, the mark varied between 1/4 and 1/2 inch in width. Extremes of cold and heat bleached it whiter than usual. In wintry air, though the thin ribbon of connective tissue contained no nerve endings, it felt like a hot wire laid on his face. In summer sun, the scar was cold. The traffic signal changed from red to green. The dog stretched his furry head forward in anticipation. Spencer drove slowly southward along the dark coast, both hands on the wheel again. He nervously searched for the red door on the eastern side of the street among the many shops and restaurants. Though no longer touching the fault line in his face, he remained conscious of it. He was never unaware that he was branded. If he smiled or frowned, he would feel the scar cinching one half of his countenance. If he laughed, his amusement would be tempered by the tension in that inelastic tissue. The metronomic windshield wipers timed the rhythm of the rain. Spencer's mouth was dry, but the palms of his hands were damp. The tightness in his chest arose as much from anxiety as from the pleasant anticipation of seeing Valerie again. He was of half a mind to go home. The new hope he harbored was surely the emotional equivalent of fool's gold. He was alone, and he was always going to be alone, except for Rocky. He was ashamed of this fresh glimmer of optimism, of the naivete it revealed, the secret need, the quiet desperation. But he kept driving. Rocky couldn't know what they were searching for, but he chuffed softly when the red landmark appeared. No doubt he was responding to a subtle change in Spencer's mood at the sight of the door. The cocktail lounge was between a Thai restaurant with steam-streaked windows and an empty storefront that had once been an art gallery. The windows of the gallery were boarded over, and squares of travertine were missing from the once elegant facade, as if the enterprise had not merely failed, but been bombed out of business. Through the silver rain, a downfall of light at the lounge entrance revealed the red door that he remembered from the previous night. Spencer hadn't been able to recall the name of the place. That lapse of memory now seemed willful, considering the scarlet neon above the entrance. The red door. A humorless laugh escaped him. After haunting so many bar rooms over the years, he had ceased to notice enough differences one from another to be able to attach names to them. In scores of towns, those countless taverns were, in their essence, the same church confessional. Sitting on a bar stool instead of kneeling on a prie-dieu, he murmured the same admissions to strangers who were not priests and could not give him absolution. His confessors were drunkards, spiritual guides as lost as he was. They could never tell him the appropriate penance he must do to find peace. Discussing the meaning of life, they were incoherent. Unlike those strangers to whom he often quietly revealed his soul, Spencer had never been drunk. Inebriation was as dreadful for him to contemplate as was suicide. To be drunk was to relinquish control. Intolerable. Control was the only thing he had. At the end of the block, Spencer turned left and parked on the secondary street. He went to bars not to drink, but to avoid being alone, and to tell his story to someone who would not remember it in the morning. He often nursed a beer or two through a long evening. Later in his bedroom, after staring toward the hidden heavens, he would finally close his eyes, only when the patterns of shadows on the ceiling inevitably reminded him of things he preferred to forget. When he switched off the engine, the rain drummed louder than before, a cold sound as chilling as the voices of dead children that sometimes called to him with wordless urgency in his worst dreams. The yellowish glow of a nearby street lamp bathed the interior of the truck, so Rocky was clearly visible. His large and expressive eyes solemnly regarded Spencer. "Maybe this is a bad idea," Spencer said. The dog craned his head forward to lick his master's right hand, which was still clenched around the wheel. He seemed to be saying that Spencer should relax and just do what he had come there to do. As Spencer moved his hand to pet the mutt, Rocky bowed his head, not to make the backs of his ears or his neck more accessible to stroking fingers, but to indicate that he was subservient and harmless. "How long have we been together?" Spencer asked the dog. Rocky kept his head down, huddling warily, but not actually trembling under his master's gentle hand. "Almost 2 years," Spencer said, answering his own question. 2 years of kindness, long walks, chasing frisbees on the beach, regular meals. And still, sometimes you think I'm going to hit you." Rocky remained in a humble posture on the passenger seat. Spencer slipped one hand under the dog's chin, forced his head up. After briefly trying to pull away, Rocky ceased all resistance. When they were eye to eye, Spencer said, "Do you trust me?" The dog self-consciously looked away, down and to the left. Spencer shook the mutt gently by the muzzle, commanding his attention again. "We keep our heads up,"
Okay? Always proud. Okay? Confident. Keep our heads up. Look people in the eye. You got that?
Rocky slipped his tongue between his half-clenched teeth and licked the fingers with which Spencer was gripping his muzzle.
I'll interpret that as yes.
He let go of the dog.
This cocktail lounge isn't the place I can take you.
No offense. In certain taverns, though Rocky was not a guide dog, he could lie at Spencer's feet, even sit on a stool, and no one would object to the violation of health laws. Usually a dog was the least of the infractions for which the joint would be cited if a city inspector happened to visit. The Red Door, however, still had pretensions to class, and Rocky wouldn't be welcome. Spencer got out of the truck, slammed the door. He engaged the locks and security system with the remote control on his keychain. He could not count on Rocky to protect the explorer. This was one dog who would never scare off a determined car thief, unless the would-be thief suffered an extreme phobic aversion to having his hand licked. After sprinting through the cold rain to the shelter of an awning that skirted the corner building, Spencer paused to look back. Having moved into the driver's seat, the dog stared out, nose pressed to the side window, one ear pricked, one ear drooping. His breath was fogging the glass, but he wasn't barking. Rocky never barked. He just stared, waited. He was 70 pounds of pure love and patience. Spencer turned away from the truck in the side street, rounded the corner, and hunched his shoulders against the chilly air. Judging by the liquid sounds of the night, the coast and all the works of civilization that stood upon it might have been merely ramparts of ice melting into the black Pacific maw. Rain drizzled off the awning, gurgled in gutters, and splashed beneath the tires of passing cars. At the threshold of audibility, more sensed than heard, the ceaseless rumble of surf announced the steady erosion of beaches and bluffs. As Spencer was passing the boarded-up art gallery, someone spoke from the shadows in the deeply recessed entrance. The voice was as dry as the night was damp, hoarse and grating.
"I know what you are."
Halting, Spencer squinted into the gloom. A man sat in the entryway, legs splayed, back against the gallery door. Unwashed and unbarbered, he seemed less a man than a heap of black rags saturated with so much organic filth that malignant life had arisen in it by spontaneous generation.
"I know what you are," the vagrant repeated softly but clearly.
A miasma of body odor and urine and the fumes of cheap wine rose out of the doorway. The number of shambling, drug-addicted, psychotic denizens of the streets had increased steadily since the late 70s, when most of the mentally ill had been freed from sanitariums in the name of civil liberties and compassion. They roamed America's cities, championed by politicians, but untended, an army of the living dead. The penetrating whisper was as desiccated and eerie as the voice of a reanimated mummy.
"I know what you are."
The prudent response was to keep moving. The paleness of the vagrant's face above the beard and below the tangled hair became dimly visible in the gloom. His sunken eyes were as bottomless as abandoned wells.
"I know what you are."
"Nobody knows," Spencer said.
Sliding the fingertips of his right hand along his scar, he walked past the shuttered gallery and the ruined man.
"Nobody knows,"
whispered the vagrant. Perhaps his commentary on passers-by, which at first had seemed eerily perceptive, even portentous, was nothing more than mindless repetition of the last thing he had heard from the most recent scornful citizen to reply to him.
"Nobody knows."
Spencer stopped in front of the cocktail lounge. Was he making a dreadful mistake? He hesitated with his hand on the red door. Once more the hobo spoke from the shadows. Through the sizzle of the rain, his admonition now had the haunting quality of a static, shredded voice on the radio speaking from a distant station in some far corner of the world.
"Nobody knows."
Spencer opened the red door and went inside. On a Wednesday night, no host was at the reservations podium in the vestibule. Maybe there wasn't a front man on Fridays or Saturdays either. The joint wasn't exactly jumping. The warm air was stale and filigreed with blue cigarette smoke. In the far left corner of the rectangular main room, a piano player under a spotlight worked through a spiritless rendition of Tangerine. Decorated in black and gray and polished steel, with mirrored walls, with Art Deco fixtures that cast overlapping rings of moody sapphire blue light on the ceiling, the lounge once had recaptured a lost age with style. Now the upholstery was scuffed, the mirrors streaked, the steel was dull under a residue of old smoke. Most tables were empty. A few older couples sat near the piano. Spencer went to the bar, which was to the right, and settled on the stool at the end, as far from the musician as he could get. The bartender had thinning hair, a sallow complexion, and watery gray eyes. His practiced politeness and pale smile couldn't conceal his boredom. He functioned with robotic efficiency and detachment, discouraging conversation by never making eye contact. 2 50-ish men in suits sat farther along the bar, each alone, each frowning at his drink. Their shirt collars were unbuttoned, ties askew. They looked dazed, glum, as if they were advertising agency executives who'd been pink-slipped 10 years ago, but still got up every morning and dressed for success because they didn't know what else to do. Maybe they came to the red door because it had been where they'd unwound after work in the days when they'd still had hope. The only waitress serving the tables was strikingly beautiful, half Vietnamese and half black. She wore the costume that she, and Valerie, had worn the previous evening. Black heels, short black skirt, short-sleeved black sweater. Valerie had called her Rosie. After 15 minutes, Spencer stopped Rosie when she passed nearby with a tray of drinks. "Is Valerie working tonight?"
"Supposed to be," she said.
He was relieved. Valerie hadn't lied. He had thought perhaps she'd misled him as a gentle way of brushing him off.
"I'm kind of worried about her," Rosie said.
"Why's that?"
"Well, the shift started an hour ago."
Her gaze kept straying to his scar.
"She hasn't called in."
"Was she not often late?"
"Val? Not her. She's organized."
"How long has she worked here?"
"About 2 months. She..."
The woman shifted her gaze from the scar to his eyes.
"Are you a friend of hers or something?"
"I was here last night, this same stool. Things were slow, so Valerie and I talked a while."
"Yeah, I remember you," Rosie said,
and it was obvious that she couldn't understand why Valerie had spent time with him. He didn't look like any woman's dream man. He wore running shoes, jeans, a work shirt, and a denim jacket purchased at Kmart. Essentially the same outfit he'd worn on his first visit. No jewelry. His watch was a Timex. And the scar, of course. Always the scar.
"Called her place," Rosie said. "No answer. I'm worried."
"An hour late, that's not so much. Could have had a flat tire."
"In this city," Rosie said, her face hardening with anger that aged her 10 years in an instant. "She could have been gang-raped. Stabbed by some 12-year-old punk, wrecked on crack. Maybe even shot dead by a carjacker in her own driveway."
"Well, you're a real optimist, huh?"
"I watched the news."
She carried the drinks to a table at which sat 2 older couples whose expressions were more sour than celebratory. Having missed the new Puritanism that had captured many Californians, they were puffing furiously on cigarettes. They appeared to be afraid that the recent total ban on smoking in restaurants might be extended tonight to bar rooms and homes, and that each cigarette might be their last. While the piano player clinked through "The Last Time I Saw Paris," Spencer took 2 small sips of beer. Judging by the palpable melancholy of the patrons in the bar, it might actually have been June 1940, with German tanks rolling down the Champs-Élysées and with omens of doom blazing in the night sky. A few minutes later, the waitress approached Spencer again.
"I guess I sounded a little paranoid," she said.
"Not at all. I watched the news, too."
"It's just that Valerie is so..."
"Special," Spencer said,
finishing her thought so accurately that she stared at him with a mixture of surprise and vague alarm, as if she suspected that he had actually read her mind.
"Yeah, special. You can know her only a week, and, well, you want her to be happy. You want good things to happen to her."
It doesn't take a week, Spencer thought. One evening.
Rosie said, "Maybe because there's this hurt in her. She'd been hurt a lot." How? He asked. Who? She shrugged. It's nothing I know, nothing she ever said. You just feel it about her. He also had sensed a vulnerability in Valerie. But she's tough, too, Rosie said. Gee, I don't know why I'm so jumpy about this. It's not like I'm her big sister. Anyway, everyone's got a right to be late now and then.
The waitress turned away, and Spencer sipped his warm beer. The piano player launched into It Was a Very Good Year, which Spencer disliked even when Sinatra sang it, though he was a Sinatra fan. He knew the song was intended to be reflective in tone, even mildly pensive. However, it seemed terribly sad to him. Not the sweet wistfulness of an older man reminiscing about the women he had loved, but the grim ballad of someone at the bitter end of his days looking back on a barren life devoid of deep relationships. He supposed that his interpretation of the lyrics was an expression of his fear that decades hence, when his own life burned out, he would fade away in loneliness and remorse. He checked his watch. Valerie was now an hour and a half late. The waitress's uneasiness had infected him. An insistent image rose in his mind's eye. Valerie's face, half concealed by a spill of dark hair and a delicate scrollwork of blood, one cheek pressed against the floor, eyes wide and unblinking. He knew his concern was irrational. She was merely late for work. There was nothing ominous about that. Yet minute by minute, his apprehension deepened. He put his unfinished beer on the bar, got off the stool, and walked through the blue light to the red door and into the chilly night, where the sound of marching armies was only the rain beating on the canvas awnings. As he passed the art gallery doorway, he heard the shadow-wrapped vagrant weeping softly. He paused, affected. Between strangled sounds of grief, the half-seen stranger whispered the last thing Spencer had said to him earlier.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows.
That short declaration evidently had acquired a personal and profound meaning for him, because he spoke the two words not in the tone in which Spencer had spoken, but with quiet, intense anguish.
Nobody knows.
Though Spencer knew that he was a fool for funding the wretch's further self-destruction, he fished a crisp $10 bill from his wallet. He leaned into the gloomy entryway, into the fetid stink that the hobo exuded, and held out the money. Here, take this. The hand that rose to the offering was either clad in a dark glove or exceedingly filthy. It was barely discernible in the shadows. As the bill was plucked out of Spencer's fingers, the vagrant keened thinly.
Nobody. Nobody.
You'll be all right, Spencer said sympathetically. It's only life. We all get through it.
It's only life. We all get through it,
the vagrant whispered.
Plagued once more by the mental image of Valerie's dead face, Spencer hurried to the corner, into the rain, to the explorer. Through the side window, Rocky watched him approaching. As Spencer opened the door, the dog retreated to the passenger seat. Spencer got in the truck and pulled the door shut, bringing with him the smell of damp denim and the ozone odor of the storm.
You miss me, killer?
Rocky shifted his weight from side to side a couple of times, and he tried to wag his tail even while sitting on it. As he started the engine, Spencer said,
You'll be pleased to hear that I didn't make an ass of myself in there.
The dog sneezed,
but only because she didn't show up.
The dog cocked his head curiously. Putting the car in gear, popping the handbrake, Spencer said,
So, instead of quitting and going home while I'm ahead of the game, what do you think I'm going to do now,
Apparently the dog didn't have a clue.
I'm going to poke in where it's none of my business, give myself a second chance to screw up. Tell me straight, pal, do you think I've lost my mind?
Rocky merely panted. Pulling the truck away from the curb, Spencer said,
Yeah, you're right. I'm a basket case.
He headed directly for Valerie's house. She lived 10 minutes from the bar. The previous night he had waited with Rocky and the Explorer outside the red door until 2 o'clock in the morning, and had followed Valerie when she drove home shortly after closing time. Because of his surveillance training, he knew how to tail a subject discreetly. He was confident that she hadn't spotted him. He was not equally confident, however, about his ability to explain to her
or to himself, why he had followed her. After one evening of conversation with her, periodically interrupted by her attention to the few customers in the nearly deserted lounge, Spencer was overcome by the desire to know everything about her. Everything. In fact, it was more than a desire, it was a need, and he was compelled to satisfy it. Although his intentions were innocent, he was mildly ashamed of his budding obsession. The night before, he had sat in the Explorer across the street from her house, staring at her lighted windows. All were covered with translucent drapes, and on one occasion her shadow played briefly across the folds of cloth, like a spirit glimpsed in candlelight at a séance. Shortly before 3:30 in the morning, the last light went out. While Rocky lay curled in sleep on the back seat, Spencer had remained on watch another hour, gazing at the dark house, wondering what books Valerie read, what she enjoyed doing on her days off, what her parents were like, where she had lived as a child, what she dreamed about when she was contented, and what shape her nightmares took when she was disturbed. Now, less than 24 hours later, he headed to her place again with a fine-grained anxiety abrading his nerves. She was late for work, just late. His excessive concern told him more than he cared to know about the inappropriate intensity of his interest in this woman. Traffic thinned as he drove farther from Ocean Avenue into residential neighborhoods. The languorous liquid glimmer of wet blacktop fostered a false impression of movement, as if every street might be a lazy river easing toward its own far delta. Valerie Keene lived in a quiet neighborhood of stucco and clapboard bungalows built in the late 40s. Those 2- and 3-bedroom homes offered more charm than space. Trellised front porches from which hung great capes of bougainvillea, decorative shutters flanking windows, interestingly scalloped or molded or carved fascia boards under the eaves, fanciful roof lines, deeply recessed dormers. Because Spencer didn't want to draw attention to himself, he drove past the woman's place without slowing. He glanced casually to the right toward her dark bungalow on the south side of the block. Rocky mimicked him, but the dog seemed to find nothing more alarming about the house than did his master. At the end of the block, Spencer turned right and drove south. The next few streets to the right were cul-de-sacs. He passed them by. He didn't want to park on a dead-end street. That was a trap. At the next main avenue, he hung a right again and parked at the curb in a neighborhood similar to the one in which Valerie lived. He turned off the thumping windshield wipers, but not the engine. He still hoped that he might regain his senses, put the truck in gear, and go home. Rocky looked at him expectantly, one ear up, one ear down. "I'm not in control," Spencer said, as much to himself as to the curious dog. "And I don't know why." Rain sluiced down the windshield. Through the film of rippling water, the streetlights shimmered. He sighed and switched off the engine. When he'd left home, he'd forgotten an umbrella. The short dash to and from the red door had left him slightly damp, but the longer walk back to Valerie's house would leave him soaked. He was not sure why he hadn't parked in front of her place. Training, perhaps. Instinct. Paranoia. Maybe all three. Leaning past Rocky and enduring a warm, affectionate tongue in his ear, Spencer retrieved a flashlight from the glove compartment and tucked it in a pocket of his jacket. "Anybody messes with the truck," he said to the dog, "you rip the bastard's guts out." As Rocky yawned, Spencer got out of the Explorer. He locked it with the remote control as he walked away and turned north at the corner. He didn't bother running. Regardless of his pace, he would be soaked before he reached the bungalow. The north-south street was lined with jacarandas. They would have provided little cover even when fully dressed with leaves and cascades of purple blossoms. Now, in winter, the branches were bare. Spencer was sodden by the time he reached Valerie Street, where the jacarandas gave way to huge Indian laurels. The aggressive roots of the trees had cracked and canted the sidewalk. However, the canopy of branches and generous foliage held back the cold rain.
The big trees also prevented most of the yellowish light of the sodium vapor street lamps from reaching even the front lawns of the properties along that cloistered avenue. The trees and shrubs around the houses also were mature. Some were overgrown. If any residents were looking out windows, they would most likely be unable to see him through the screen of greenery on the deeply shadowed sidewalk. As he walked, he scanned the vehicles parked along the street. As far as he could tell, no one was sitting in any of them. A Mayflower moving van was parked across the street from Valerie's bungalow. That was convenient for Spencer because the large truck blocked those neighbors' view. No men were working at the van. The move-in or move-out must be scheduled for the morning. Spencer followed the front walkway and climbed three steps to the porch. The trellises at both ends supported not bougainvillea, but night-blooming jasmine. Though it wasn't at its seasonal peak, the jasmine sweetened the air with its singular fragrance. The shadows on the porch were deep. He doubted that he could even be seen from the street. In the gloom, he had to feel along the door frame to find the button. He could hear the doorbell ringing softly inside the house. He waited. No lights came on. The flesh crept on the back of his neck, and he sensed that he was being watched. Two windows flanked the front door and looked onto the porch. As far as he could discern, the dimly visible folds of the draperies on the other side of the glass were without any gaps through which an observer could have been studying him. He looked back at the street. Sodium yellow light transformed the downpour into glittering skeins of molten gold. At the far curb, the moving van stood half in shadows, half in the glow of the street lamps. A late model Honda and an older Pontiac were parked at the nearer curb. No pedestrians. No passing traffic. The night was silent, except for the incessant rataplan of the rain. He rang the bell once more. The crawling feeling on the nape of his neck didn't subside. He put a hand back there, half convinced that he would find a spider negotiating his rain-slick skin. No spider. As he turned to the street again, he thought that he saw furtive movement from the corner of his eye near the back of the Mayflower van. He stared for half a minute, but nothing moved in the windless night, except torrents of golden rain falling to the pavement as straight as if they were, in fact, heavy droplets of precious metal. He knew why he was jumpy. He didn't belong here. Guilt was twisting his nerves. Facing the door again, he slipped his wallet out of his right hip pocket and removed his MasterCard. Though he could not have admitted it to himself until now, he would have been disappointed if he had found lights on and Valerie at home. He was concerned about her, but he doubted that she was lying, either injured or dead, in her darkened house. He was not psychic. The image of her blood-stained face, which he'd conjured in his mind's eye, was only an excuse to make the trip here from the red door. His need to know everything about Valerie was perilously close to an adolescent longing. At the moment, his judgment was not sound. He frightened himself, but he couldn't turn back. By inserting the MasterCard between the door and jamb, he could pop the spring latch. He assumed there would be a deadbolt as well, because Santa Monica was as crime-ridden as any town in or around Los Angeles, but maybe he would get lucky. He was luckier than he hoped. The front door was unlocked. Even the spring latch wasn't fully engaged. When he twisted the knob, the door clicked open. Surprised, stricken by another tremor of guilt, he glanced back at the street again. The Indian laurels, the moving van, the cars. The rain, rain, rain. He went inside. He closed the door and stood with his back against it, dripping on the carpet, shivering. At first, the room in front of him was unrelievedly black. After a while, his vision adjusted enough for him to make out a drapery-covered window, and then a second and a third, illuminated only by the faint gray ambient light of the night beyond. For all that he could see, the blackness before him might have harbored a crowd, but he knew that he was alone. The house felt not merely unoccupied, but deserted, abandoned. Spencer took the flashlight from his jacket pocket. He hooded the beam with his left hand to ensure as much as possible that it would not be noticed by anyone outside. The beam revealed an unfurnished living room, barren from wall to wall. The carpet was milk chocolate brown. The unlined draperies were beige. The two-bulb light fixture in the ceiling could probably be operated by one of the three switches beside the front door, but he didn't try them. His soaked athletic shoes and socks squished as he crossed the living room. He stepped through an archway into a small and equally empty dining room.
Spencer thought of the Mayflower van across the street, but he didn't believe that Valerie's belongings were in it or that she had moved out of the bungalow since 4:30 the previous morning when he'd left his watch post in front of her house and returned to his own bed. Instead, he suspected that she had never actually moved in. The carpet was not marked by the pressure lines and foot indentations of furniture. No tables, chairs, cabinets, credenzas, or floor lamps had stood on it recently. If Valerie had lived in the bungalow during the 2 months that she had worked at the Red Door, she evidently hadn't furnished it and hadn't intended to call it home for any great length of time. To the left of the dining room, through an archway half the size of the first, he found a small kitchen with knotty pine cabinets and red formica countertops. Unavoidably, he left wet shoe prints on the gray tile floor. Stacked beside the two-basin sink were a single dinner plate, a bread plate, a soup bowl, a saucer, and a cup, all clean and ready for use. One drinking glass stood with the dinnerware. Next to the glass lay a dinner fork, a knife, and a spoon, which were also clean. He shifted the flashlight in his right hand, splaying a couple of fingers across the lens to partly suppress the beam, thus freeing his left hand to touch the drinking glass. He traced the rim with his fingertips. Even if the glass had been washed since Valerie had taken a drink from it, her lips had once touched the rim. He had never kissed her. Perhaps he never would. That thought embarrassed him, made him feel foolish, and forced him to consider yet again the impropriety of his obsession with this woman. He didn't belong here. He was trespassing, not merely in her home, but in her life. Until now, he had lived an honest life, if not always with undeviating respect for the law. Upon entering her house, however, he had crossed a sharp line that had scaled away his innocence, and what he had lost couldn't be regained. Nevertheless, he did not leave the bungalow. When he opened kitchen drawers and cabinets, he found them empty, except for a combination bottle and can opener. The woman owned no plates or utensils other than those stacked beside the sink. Most of the shelves in the narrow pantry were bare. Her stock of food was limited to 3 cans of peaches, 2 cans of pears, 2 cans of pineapple rings, 1 box of sugar substitute in small blue packets, 2 boxes of cereal, and a jar of instant coffee. The refrigerator was nearly empty, but the freezer compartment was well stocked with gourmet microwave dinners. By the refrigerator was a door with a mullioned window. The 4 panes were covered by a yellow curtain, which he pushed aside far enough to see a side porch and a dark yard hammered by rain. He allowed the curtain to fall back into place. He wasn't interested in the outside world. Only in the interior spaces, where Valerie had breathed the air, taken her meals, and slept. As Spencer left the kitchen, the rubber soles of his shoes squeaked on the wet tiles. Shadows retreated before him and huddled in the corners, while darkness crowded his back again. He could not stop shivering. The damp chill in the house was as penetrating as that of the February air outside. The heat must have been off all day, which meant that Valerie had left early. On his cold face, the scar burned. A closed door was centered in the back wall of the dining room. He opened it and discovered a narrow hallway that led about 15 feet to the left and 15 to the right. Directly across the hall, another door stood half open. Beyond, he glimpsed a white tile floor and a bathroom sink. As he was about to enter the hall, he heard sounds other than the monotonous and hollow drumming of the rain on the roof. A thump and a soft scrape. He immediately switched off the flashlight. The darkness was as perfect as that in any carnival funhouse just before flickering strobe lights revealed a leering mechanical corpse. At first, the sounds had seemed stealthy, as if a prowler outside had slipped on the wet grass and bumped against the house. However, the longer Spencer listened, the more he became convinced that the source of noise might have been distant rather than nearby, and that he might have heard nothing more than a car door slamming shut out on the street or in a neighbor's driveway. He switched on the flashlight and continued his search in the bathroom. A bath towel, a hand towel, and a washcloth hung on the rack. A half-used bar of ivory lay in the plastic soap dish, but the medicine cabinet was empty. To the right of the bathroom was a small bedroom, as unfurnished as the rest of the house. The closet was empty. The second bedroom to the left of the bath was larger than the first, and it was obviously where she had slept. An inflated air mattress lay on the floor. Atop the mattress were a tangle of sheets, a single wool blanket, and a pillow. The bifold closet door stood open, revealing wire hangers dangling from an unpainted wooden pole. Although the rest of the bungalow was unadorned by artwork or decoration, something was fixed to the center of the longest wall in that bedroom. Spencer approached it, directed the light at it, and saw a full-color close-up photograph of a cockroach. It seemed to be a page from a book, perhaps an entomology text, because the caption under the photograph was in dry academic English. In close-up, the roach was about 6 inches long. It had been fixed to the wall with a single large nail that had been driven through the center of the beetle's carapace. On the floor, directly below the photograph, lay the hammer with which the spike had been pounded into the plaster. The photograph had not been decoration. Surely no one would hang a picture of a cockroach with the intention of beautifying a bedroom. Furthermore, the use of a nail, rather than pushpins or staples or scotch tape, implied that the person wielding the hammer had done so in considerable anger. Clearly, the roach was meant to be a symbol for something else. Spencer wondered uneasily if Valerie had nailed it there. That seemed unlikely. The woman with whom he'd talked the previous evening at the Red Door had seemed uncommonly gentle, kind, and all but incapable of serious anger. If not Valerie, who? As Spencer moved the flashlight beam across the glossy paper, the roach's carapace glistened as if wet. The shadows of his fingers, which half-blocked the lens, created the illusion that the beetle's spindly legs and antennae jittered briefly. Sometimes serial killers left behind signatures at the scenes of their crimes to identify their work. In Spencer's experience, that could be anything from a specific playing card to a satanic symbol carved in some part of the victim's anatomy to a single word or line of poetry scrawled in blood upon a wall. The nailed photo had the feeling of such a signature, although it was stranger than anything he had seen or about which he had read in the hundreds of case studies with which he was familiar. A faint nausea rippled through him. He had encountered no signs of violence in the house, but he had not yet looked in the attached single-car garage. Perhaps he would find Valerie on that cold slab of concrete, as he had seen her earlier in his mind's eye, lying with one side of her face pressed to the floor, unblinking eyes open wide, a scrollwork of blood obscuring some of her features. He knew that he was jumping to conclusions. These days, the average American routinely lived in anticipation of sudden, mindless violence, but Spencer was more sensitized to the dark possibilities of modern life than were most people. He had endured pain and terror that had marked him in many ways, and his tendency now was to expect savagery as surely as sunrises and sunsets. As he turned away from the photograph of the roach, wondering if he dared to investigate the garage, the bedroom window shattered inward, and a small black object hurtled through the draperies. At a glimpse, tumbling and airborne, it resembled a grenade. Reflexively, he switched off the flashlight, even as broken glass was still falling. In the gloom, the grenade thumped softly against the carpet. Before Spencer could turn away, he was hit by the explosion. No flash of light accompanied it, only ear-shattering sound and hard shrapnel snapping into him from his shins to his forehead. He cried out, fell, twisted, writhed, pain in his legs, hands, face. His torso was protected by his denim jacket, but his hands, God, his hands. He wrung his burning hands, hot pain, pure torment. How many fingers lost, bones shattered? Jesus, Jesus, his hands were spastic with pain, yet half numb so he couldn't assess the damage. The worst of it was the fiery agony in his forehead, cheeks, the left corner of his mouth. Excruciating. Desperate to quell the pain, he pressed his hands to his face. He was afraid of what he would find, of the damage he would feel, but his hands throbbed so fiercely that his sense of touch wasn't trustworthy. How many new scars, if he survived? How many pale and puckered cicatricial welts or red keloid monstrosities from hairline to chin? Get out. Get away. Find help. He kicked, crawled, clawed, twitched like a wounded crab through the darkness. Disoriented and terrified, he nevertheless scrambled in the right direction, across a floor now littered with what seemed to be small marbles, into the bedroom doorway. He clambered to his feet. He figured he was caught in a gang war over disputed turf. Los Angeles in the 90s was more violent than Chicago during Prohibition. Modern youth gangs were more savage and better armed than the mafia, pumped up with drugs and their own brand of racism, as cold-blooded and merciless as snakes. Gasping for breath, feeling blindly with aching hands, he stumbled into the hall. Pain coruscated through his legs, weakening him and testing his balance. Staying on his feet was as difficult as it would have been in a revolving funhouse barrel. Windows shattered in other rooms, followed by a few muffled explosions. The hallway was windowless, so he wasn't hit again. In spite of his confusion and fear, Spencer realized he didn't smell blood, didn't taste it. In fact, he wasn't bleeding. Suddenly he understood what was happening. Not a gang war. The shrapnel hadn't cut him, so it wasn't actually shrapnel. Not marbles, either, littering the floor. Hard rubber pellets from a sting grenade. Only law enforcement agencies had sting grenades. He had used them himself. Seconds ago, a SWAT team of some kind must have initiated an assault on the bungalow, launching the grenades to disable any occupants. The moving van had no doubt been covert transport for the assault force. The movement he had seen at the back of it out of the corner of his eye hadn't been imaginary after all. He should have been relieved. The assault was an action of the local police, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the FBI, or another law enforcement organization. Apparently he had stumbled into one of their operations. He knew the drill. If he dropped to the floor face down, arms extended over his head, hands spread to prove they were empty, he would be fine. He wouldn't be shot. They would handcuff him, question him, but they wouldn't harm him further. Except that he had a big problem. He didn't belong in that bungalow. He was a trespasser. From their point of view, he might even be a burglar. To them, his explanation of being there would seem lame at best. Hell, they would think it was crazy. He didn't really understand it himself, why he was so stricken with Valerie, why he had needed to know about her, why he had been bold enough and stupid enough to enter her house. He didn't drop to the floor. On wobbly legs, he staggered through the tunnel-black hall, sliding one hand along the wall. The woman was mixed up in something illegal. And at first, the authorities would think that he was involved as well. He would be taken into custody, detained for questioning, maybe even booked on suspicion of aiding and abetting Valerie in whatever she had done. They would find out who he was. The news media would dredge up his past. His face would be on television, in newspapers and magazines. He had lived many years in blessed anonymity, his new name unknown, his appearance altered by time, no longer recognizable. But his privacy was about to be stolen. He would be sent a ring at the circus again, harassed by reporters, whispered about every time he went out in public. No. Intolerable. He couldn't go through that again. He would rather die. They were cops of some kind, and he was innocent of any serious offense, but they were not on his side right now. Without meaning to destroy him, they would do so simply by exposing him to the press. More shattering glass, two explosions. The officers on the SWAT team were taking no chances, as if they thought they were up against people crazed on PCP or something worse. Spencer had reached the midpoint of the hall, where he stood between two doorways, a dim grayness beyond the right-hand door, the dining room. On his left, the bathroom. He stepped into the bathroom, closed the door, hoping to buy time to think. The stinging in his face, hands, and legs was slowly subsiding. Rapidly, repeatedly, he clenched his hands, then released them, trying to improve the circulation and work off the numbness. From the far end of the house came a wood-splintering crash, hard enough to make the wall shudder. It was probably the front door slamming open or going down. Another crash, the kitchen door. They were in the house. They were coming. No time to think. He had to move, relying on instinct and on military training that was, he hoped, at least as extensive as that of the men who were hunting him. In the back wall of the cramped room, above the bathtub, the blackness was broken by a rectangle of faint gray light. He stepped into the tub and with both hands quickly explored the frame of that small window. He wasn't convinced that it was big enough to provide a way out, but it was the only possible route of escape. If it had been fixed or jalousied, he would have been trapped. Fortunately, it was a single pane that opened inward from the top on a heavy-duty piano hinge. Collapsible elbow braces on both sides clicked softly when fully extended, locking the window open. He expected the faint squeak of the hinge and the click of the braces to elicit a shout from someone outside, but the unrelenting drone of the rain screened what sounds he made. No alarm was raised. Spencer gripped the window ledge and levered himself into the opening. Cold rain spattered his face. The humid air was heavy with the fecund smells of saturated earth, jasmine, and grass. The backyard was a tapestry of gloom, woven exclusively from shades of black and graveyard grays, washed by rain that blurred its details. At least one man, more likely two, from the SWAT team had to be covering the rear of the house. However, though Spencer's vision was keen, he could not force any of the interwoven shadows to resolve into a human form. For a moment, his upper body seemed wider than the frame, but he hunched his shoulders, twisted, wriggled, and scraped through the opening. The ground was a short drop from the window. He rolled once on the wet grass, then lay flat on his stomach, head raised, surveying the night, still unable to spot any adversaries.